Welcome back to another episode of She's Busy AF. I'm your host, Lauren Loretto, and today we have Monique Benoit joining us on the podcast. Okay, you might have seen the title. This is definitely a different episode. We normally talk about service-based B2B, but listen up. If you are a service-based B2B business, this is definitely what you want to listen to. If you have any clients in e-com or you want to understand how that world might work, listen, a lot of service-based businesses enter the world of product, of CPG, of e-com, and it's good to know how these things work. So Monique and I had a very interesting conversation, and spoiler alert, we talked about how D2C, which is direct to consumer, is actually not really a strong strategy anymore, and getting into retail and working with buyers in retail, you know, across different retail conglomerates is a better idea. So we have some really interesting conversations about that. But Monique is a bold leader. She's been in this consumer product space for a very long time. She's a champion for inclusivity. She brings a really high level of energy and passion to her work. And what makes her so cool and so knowledgeable is that she's worked in retail buying at Target Corporation and Anthropologie. She's worked with a variety of health and wellness brands as a team lead for Beauty Channel and Emerson Group. And she's currently the chief advisor of Soulful Creations, where she helps beauty brands who've seen their organic growth stall develop strategies to achieve that predictable growth. So she's really a great person to listen to all of these different things that you should probably know as either a marketer or someone who's looking to launch a CPG product. Tune into this episode. I really hope you enjoy it. I absolutely loved getting to know Monique, and I know you will too. Let's dive in. All right. Welcome, Monique. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, we have a lot to talk about, but first things first, I know I kind of intro'd you, but I would love for you to tell us a little bit about you.
Yeah, so I joke and say that I study chemical engineering in undergrad, but I really am truly a beauty and fashion enthusiast. So I learned early on that I probably shouldn't have been an engineer, but it took me a number of years to actually find my way to the realm of fashion and beauty and brand strategy where I am now. So I joined Target after getting my MBA, worked as a retail buyer for a number of years, learned really the power that retail buyers had in terms of bringing product to shelves. Loved it, loved that I could leverage this business acumen to run the business, grow the business, had some fun times bringing in some amazing brands at some times when going after or partnering with indie brands wasn't really a thing. And then worked at Anthropologie for a number of years, also in buying, got to do some actual product design there and development, which was so much fun. And then I went to kind of a brokerage where I was selling beauty brands into Ulta. And I currently have my own company where I work with privately held beauty brands on brand strategy and growth strategy and trying to get them to scale at retail. So a lot of fun times.
Well, that's crazy. There's a lot of investment, right, that goes into like starting a product-based business.
Yes.
Yeah. She laughs. Yeah. I mean, no, I'm saying that because it's like, I'm thinking like, okay, like I say, I have a product I want to launch tomorrow. Like what, for anyone who might ever be considering launching a product, like what is the quick and dirty rundown of like that process?
Well, I always joke and say, if you want to make money, you don't start a CPG brand if that's like the end goal. If your end goal is truly to make money, I wouldn't advise you to start a CPG business. It's not to say that it can't happen, but that's definitely not the quickest path. So first is really ideating your product. I mean, especially if the goal is to be successful, right? So what is your target audience and then what product are you providing them? Hopefully the product isn't out there yet, or there's some new spin or new angle that you have on the product. From there, it's a matter of figuring out how you're manufacturing your product. Are you making it in your kitchen at home? Do you have a supplier that you're working with or a manufacturer? And then from there, you're really setting the retail. And hopefully, if you have scale in mind, you're thinking about all of the additional costs based on the retailers that you want to work with and factoring those things in so that once you set your retail, you know you're in a place where you can make business both in the short term and the long term.
Okay. So you mentioned something, make sure you have a product that like, you know, isn't heavily out there yet. So you're telling me I shouldn't go launch like a mascara line tomorrow.
I mean, you can. I just don't know how successful you'll be. Like I said, this is why I say, I don't know if you want to make business. I mean, the goal in creating a product, I would think, especially with sustainability being top of mind, is not to just create something else that's out there. The goal is to provide something that's new, something that has yet to be experienced. So is there a new ingredient that you're focusing on that I haven't heard of? Is there some patented technology that you're leveraging because you're a chemist and you came up with your own formulation that you want to bring to the market because there are amazing clinical results? Or are you bringing together a new conglomerate of products that have never been put together? Like maybe you're bringing together roller skates and some kind of foot cream, and you're tying it into wellness, and you're like, this is going to be the next big thing. I don't know. I just made that off the top of my dome.
I love it.
But you get what I'm saying. You know what I mean? Like, there's an edge there. There's something there that's like, well, roller skates are trending. I always seem to have cracked feet after I put on those socks from roller skating. Maybe there's something there. I mean, I don't know if there is something there, but you get what I'm saying in terms of really thinking about what's already out there and then how can I add a new spin on it so that you actually have potential success of, you know, making money and doing something okay. different.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So say we've got this product, right? It's different. It's, you know, got potential. What are some common challenges that brands face when they're trying to now sell that product in retail, like get it outside of just them and into a store?
Yes, I think one of the biggest challenges that brands have first is just getting the retailer's attention, especially when you're small, because you don't necessarily have connections. Many brand founders don't have connections where they know buying teams. And so that means that you need to essentially generate virality to become noticed by either selling a ridiculous amount and then populating into, you know, the Nielsens and the IRIs so that they say, hey, this new brand is only this small percentage of the share, but the growth is through the roof, right? You think of like a Hero Cosmetics, the growth that they were seeing, they have these acne patches, right? So think of like, okay, instead of a Band-Aid to target like covering up a wound, let's cover up this acne spot, which is like a wound on your face, and then target healing it. Patches are like going, they're driving a lot of growth in skincare right now. So that's something where it's like a retailer is going to notice you and you might not have to do as much outreach yourself because the proof is in the pudding. That's more so the exception than it is the norm, especially with the number of beauty brands that are out here these days. So getting visibility from the retailer is huge. And then because there is so much access where anyone can manufacture a product these days, you know, think 20 years ago, there was a much tighter reins on who had access to suppliers and who could actually manufacture products. Now it's kind of like anyone who has a cell phone can almost, you know, get in touch with people and manufacture it. And so with that, that means that there's a lot more noise out there. So that means there's more that the retailers have to sift through and then also more that consumers have to sift through. And so getting to the right consumer is going to cost a lot more. Everyone is familiar, or at least hopefully most consumer brands are familiar with the changes in iOS and how that impacted brands' ability to access consumers. Before, you know, like I think in the 2010s, it was like if I was on a site and I had searched for something, I had searched for skincare. Now, anybody who's a new brand who's searching for skincare is like, that girl searched for skincare. She also just bought glasses from Warby Parker. And she also, you know, bought some vegan something. They have all the demographics that they need to say, she's our person. That's our target consumer. And now all of that information is hidden, which I'm grateful for, but it makes it that much more difficult for brands to then acquire new customers. Because now instead of being able to be targeted and saying, this is our specific archetype, I have to cast this huge net, which then becomes more expensive, which then becomes a barrier for me to continue to make a profitable product. So I would say getting into retail, reaching your customers, because that customer acquisition cost is so high, then also being able to really craft a story that's going to cut through the noise. And really, I think like with that, it's kind of like being differentiated. I think a lot of brands think they're differentiated, but they're not.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that brings up an interesting thought. there's so many brands I think that don't make it into retail, correct? Like they don't, but like some of them don't want to, and they end up kind of being direct to consumer in a sense.
Yeah. Which is no longer profitable, people are finding.
It's not. Okay. Talk about that.
No, I mean, the DTC model just isn't working because of that increased cost for customer acquisition costs. So without that ease of access and customer acquisition, you now aren't able to quickly scale your product, which is how you essentially can increase your profitability. Then you throw in the fact that supply chain costs went through the roof mm-hmm. when COVID happened. So you now have increased supply chain, more strain in general on the timeline to get product from your manufacturer to your end consumer. And so that DTC model of, hey, we're cutting out these costs. Hey, we're making this more affordable. It's like, well, your costs went up. So that means that your margin is getting smaller unless you're increasing your retail, which then for me as the consumer kind of defeats the purpose of us working together in the first place, right? I came to you because you said you were cheaper, right? If I think of like a Warby Parker, a Brooklinen, like Casper, all of these DTC businesses, Everlane, the whole model was built out of we're going directly to you and cutting out a lot of these middle people, but a lot of those costs that were right there, they increased. And so it's like that benefit that you get with retail, which is huge exposure, which is huge shipments, right? Big orders. That now is no longer, like the math just isn't mathing anymore.
Wow, that's so true. It's funny. Like I'm a consumer of like Warby Parker, Brooklinen, like all of those brands. And I appreciate that sometimes, but I could see the flip side of that with everything that you're saying. That's crazy. What are some specific insights that can be valuable for brands who are trying to sell to retailers?
So first, I think brands should start with who that retailer's target consumer is. Every retailer has a consumer archetype that they're going after. You can say that everyone shops everywhere, but I mean, there's a partial truth in there, but also there's definitely some people who are going to say, I pick Walmart over Target and vice versa, right? And there might be values that are tied to that. There might be, and the values could differ. It could be because of the things that the brand support. It could be because of money. It could be because of assortment, variety of things. But there are definitely target consumers based on the retailer. So I say first, shop that store, shop that category, look and see what's available so that you can do the work to say, okay, does it seem like I would fit in at Walmart body care if I'm selling a $40 body lotion? Probably not, right? So like if you go to Walmart and say, hey, I want to sell this $40 body lotion, they're likely not even going to give you a shot because you clearly haven't considered who their consumer is. So why would we talk, you know? Other insights that I would consider is just where things are with culture. So I think timing has a lot to do with a brand's success than folks often give it credit. So if I think about when I was at Target, my claim to fame was that I brought Honey Pot Company in. So I found that brand. I was the buyer on the, you know, menstruation and incontinence desk. And I was very intentional about trying to bring some Black brands to areas that were outside of textured hair care. And so when I found that brand, I said, man, this is awesome. It's a natural brand. There's nothing natural offered in this feminine wash space. It's vegan and it's still like $9.99. So not too much of a price premium. I think this is like gonna sell like hotcakes because the consumer wants natural products. So even if this brand has low visibility, the fact that the product itself is natural, it should sell. It should sell based on who the target consumer is, right? Because the target guest, I knew that we over-indexed with natural customers, you know, folks who like natural ingredients and stuff like that. So it's kind of like I took that consumer insights to say, hey, consumers really care a lot about natural products. Let's see what brands or products we can bring in. Okay, timing-wise, there's not anything available. This is probably going to sell like hotcakes. And I mean, however many years later, I think a recent New York Times article said, you know, Honey Pot Company did like $100 million in sales now in 2022, it said. So obviously, you know, it did well. But could another brand do that now? No, Just know, yeah, because the timing mattered. And so also looking at what you're trying to launch, even thinking about things like, you know, personal devices and sexual health. I remember I also bought that category when I was at Target. The conversation around what those devices were and even talking about it was very taboo, even in 2015. But now there's this whole conversation around sexual health, being sexual wellness and being a way to practice self-care, where there are more conversations where if you are a brand that maybe manufactures personal devices, you're going to maybe have an easier conversation with retailers now about it. Whereas 10 years ago, maybe it was very difficult because it was more taboo. So I think this is where cultural insights matter, insights about that retailer really matter. And then also always tapping into who your core consumer is, that matters, because that's ultimately going to be a matter of, do you have all of those things matching up right? Do you have the right price? Are you looking at the right retailer for the location? And is it that right timing to tell the story that you're trying to tell?
Yeah. Okay. So that brings me back to the question I wanted to ask earlier. What does a typical markup look like from a retailer? As someone who's creating the product, like, do you have kind of like your bare minimum threshold all the way up to like, do you have like a sliding scale, or is there typically like a, this is my price for retailers and I don't budge on that?
It's going to vary. It's going to vary based on your model and based on that retailer's model. So, you know, there's a variety of different types of retailers. You can think of a Walmart as like an everyday low price retailer. Walmart does not have sales. Walmart markets everything with the best price that is out there on the market. For the most part, you know that if you go to Walmart, you're not going to get a price that's better than that. Now, Target also says they're like an everyday low price, but it's, you know, questionable in terms of, hey, are they always everyday low price? Or today it seemed like y'all were a dollar more. But generally speaking, you know, they're going to have a couple more promotions though, right? Yeah. And so with promotions means that typically brands are funding those promotions. So if you are going to a Target and you typically buy a bottle of lotion for $10, but it's on sale for $8, that brand is going to be paying Target the $2 difference between the MSRP and that sale price to essentially keep Target margin whole for the sale of that item.
I'm literally shocked.
Yeah, it's so interesting how many people don't know this.
No, I always thought that retailers purchase the product and then it's up to them to control their margins.
Well, yeah. And they control the margins by charging it back to the brand to say, if you want us to keep this margin, you need to pay for it. We as the retailer are giving you visibility and foot traffic. We're giving you distribution, like all the people. So in return, you keep us margin whole, because us paying for all this retail overhead, us paying to have lights and people in the store to check you out and actually stock the shelves, that costs money. And y'all don't have to pay for any of that. So you need to pay me for that difference. So like that goes into the margin difference. I would say most retailers have some type of pricing structure where brands are funding markdowns and promotions. And if brands don't know how that works, that's one big place where they can kind of take a misstep and not have the right margins factored in terms of, okay, I'm manufacturing this product for, you know, 25 cents and I'm selling it for $10. So what are the other costs that are going to go into it so that I can ultimately make money? I have to market the product. I have to manufacture the products. I have to pay the manufacturer for the cost to manufacture it and to ship it to wherever I'm getting to. I have to pay any tariffs or any other fees to get to a landed cost, right? Because your manufactured cost oftentimes is different from your landed cost. Then once you get to your landed cost, you're saying, okay, what are the other fees? What are the fees to get into this retailer? Are there slotting fees? Are there fees for promotions? Are there additional just contract terms that I have to pay because I'm partnering with retailer A versus retailer B, whether it's like off invoice or other fees that you're paying to play once again? And then once you get to all those fees, through all of that, you finally get to, you know, make some money. And this is where, like I said early on, you don't go into CPG to make money necessarily from the jump, because there are a lot of hidden fees and you either have to know it going into it because you grew up in the business, or you kind of find out the hard way and fingers crossed, you either have some intellectual property on the item so that you can still kind of make out and make some good money.
So how does that work with store brands?
So store brands typically, I mean, I'd say every retailer might do it a little bit differently, but at the places where I've worked, there were designers, there were sourcing people or production people who would then go out to suppliers and manufacturers and say, I want this toothbrush or I want this facial wipe and I need it to hit this cost. And then with production or sourcing, it's really a numbers game. I have these sustainability or production minimums that I need to hit based on the retailer that I am working with. And then from there, I'm costing it out and I'm saying, this is the order that I need, the quantity that I need. And then they're going to give me a cost based on the quantity. So it's, you don't have marketing costs typically when you're private label. Your main costs are really just all of that supplier cost to manufacture it and then whatever cost to get it shipped to your DCs. So those are typically a retailer's margin boosters, private label.
I was going to say, like, that makes so much sense. This is where my mind goes. And now next time I go to Target or Walmart, I'm going to be like, But yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And like, I mean, we're talking food and it's a different segment now, but I'm always so curious about Trader Joe's and how Trader Joe's was able to make a name for themselves is on like 99% of their store being Trader Joe's.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense though, because in food, you see some retailers are better at it than others. Like Target did this with Good and Gather. They just came out with Favorite Day, which is like a fun, you know, you think about like, if you buy trail mix at Target, it is good. Like, yeah. I don't know what they do. Well, I do know what they do because I actually used to do taste tests with the food team, which was so much fun. Oh my gosh. You just go and you're like, I can taste ravioli today. Absolutely. Block off my calendar. Sounds like fun. But no, like, you know, the places where it's like they're investing in research and development and they want their private label to really be competitive so that the brand has equity in it of itself. Versus some private labels, you know, they're really just about getting the best cost available. Trader Joe's was coming to the table and they said, hey, we're going to make a tomato basil marinara and it's going to taste good and it's going to be $1.99. So I'm sure that they have folks at their headquarters that are testing and that are adding ingredients to say, how can we make this better? How can we make this better? And then they also have sourcing partners who are saying, how can we make this cost less so that we can continue to deliver on both taste and cost? But yeah, that's how private label works.
So cool. I love Trader Joe's. I love that it's also not close to me because I spend all my money there. All right. Okay. The other thing I wanted to ask about was regional versus national. So I feel like when someone's creating a product, I think someone who's like maybe super vanilla to it is not in the family, like just has a passion. I think we can tend to think like, wow, I'm going to have to, if I'm selling to a store, is it regional? Is it national? Like what should I be planning for? How does that work?
Again, it depends on the retailer. I know retailers like a Whole Foods, they in some cases do allow brands to launch at a regional level where you'll just be in, let's say, the Southwest region or the Northeast region, and you can sell in those clusters of stores and then expand there out. For many of the national retailers, like a Target or a Walmart, they still might have clusters where they segment things out within themselves. But that process to get there is still similar in terms of you're typically going through the buyer and trying to get into that team to sell your product in at all. So I say the regional thing is more of a play if you're talking more like food. That's where like the Whole Foods came in, or some of these natural channels where you do have, I think, a little bit of a more local regional selling option. Whereas a lot of the mass retailers, they have some systems in place, some teams that allow you to segment things out, but you're still generally speaking kind of selling to your corporate buyer who owns the whole category. And then they're making those decisions to say, okay, let me talk to my localization team to maybe understand what chips I need to have in Philadelphia versus the chips that I need to have in Michigan to make sure that it feels authentic to that grocery store. Like, I think in Philly, I knew that I wanted to have my HERS honey mesquite barbecue chips. They are so delicious. And those are the chips that I want. If they don't have them, I'm looking like they're only offered in this region. So why don't you have them? In Detroit, Better Made are the chips that everybody wants to have. They're Michigan made. They are very good chips. So it's kind of like, depending on the category that you're in, that localization strategy might be more important. And so there's going to be more impact and focus on it. But I see that happen a lot more in food versus in beauty.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's a good point. How important is branding and packaging?
Very.
And we can centralize this to beauty if that's the best place to talk. Oh, love your Owala bottle. I don't have one, but I bought that one for my sister for Christmas last year.
I absolutely love it. I love that it gives me the option for both a straw or a big mouth. I know it's like
they're
weird, but
TTC, aren't they?
Oh, for sure. They're like at Whole Foods.
Are they? Oh my
god. That's where I bought mine. And they're actually at Target now too. Yep.
No. Yep. No. Don't tell me that.
They are at Target now. I think Target buyers are good though. They can find like good stuff and then they're like, oh, I'm gonna pick this up and then it's awesome. But branding and packaging is really important. It is how you stand out on the shelf. This is across category. So if we think about how to disrupt a category, you can do it in a number of ways. You can do it with an ingredient. You can also do it with packaging and branding. So if I think about the hair care brand Monday and that light pastel pink, not quite baby pink, right? It's almost like a beige, you know, not quite beige, not quite pink. But the bottles have these unique shapes so that when you're just going down the hair care aisle and it's like, okay, I see Maui. Okay, I see even NYC, color, 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 all these like, and then it's like solid color block. It stops you, right? It's different from everything else that you see for the time being until other people start to do that, right? You see like Kristen S. has like solid color blocks now, and you're kind of seeing other brands move towards that. But I do think that packaging can allow you to stand out on the shelf. When I was a buyer and I launched organic tampons at Target and launched them in aisle, I brought in the brand This Is Elle. The differentiator for the brand This Is Elle was that their tampons were wrapped in these little containers, you know, or in plastic that looked like candy coated wrappers. Like they looked like candy. The prints were fashionable. They were cute. It wasn't necessarily just like yellow for regular, green for super. It was like, it was giving blue chevron. It was giving green forest. It was giving ombre, all the things, right? And then it was in this clear container that had a rose gold like little top. I'm sold. Like, put it on the top of my toilet. Someone will think it's candy. They'll open it up and be like, what? But you're still like, this is great, right? Like, it's cute. It's different. It's going to stop me in my path because I'm used to just seeing boxes and boxes and boxes and not just like this beautiful packaging. Now, if someone were to do that now, it's obviously not as differentiated. I've seen like very fun things though in terms of packaging, especially in that aisle from like cardboard boxes or things that look like milk containers, you know, milk cartons or little like ice cream kind of tops. I'm thinking about like new packaging ideas, not just in that aisle, but things that are different, definitely differentiated because it just makes it fresh and you're almost like, why not? I'm going to try it. No, it's ultimately your branding though that's going to keep people coming back because you can try it for one time, but then coming back for more is, does this product work? And then is this product resonating with me in a way where I'm like, I want to learn more about this. Like ultimately I knew when I think about some of the brands that I love that I continue to buy from, it's really a matter of efficacy and I really like what the brands stand for. And so I'm going to continue to buy the brands.
That's so funny. It's so funny how everyone shops differently. It's like for me, I am very much like the aesthetic, but also price shopper.
Okay.
And the effectiveness too. So aesthetic, price, and like effectiveness. And like, I don't often look deeper, but when I learn about brands, it sticks on me. So like, for example, speaking of Monday, do you know Kevin Murphy does the same thing? I don't think they're in stores, but Kevin Murphy, is also a hair care product, and they are shaped similarly. And their reasoning for that is that they can be more sustainable because they can fit more in a box. Mm. Like, there's not as much space when they're square like that.
Interesting.
As opposed to like
round.
If it's circular, yeah, you have like gaps and holes. So that was like, I was like really fascinated by that. And that stuck with me about Kevin Murphy. When I see Monday though, I feel the same way. So actually I've purchased that brand. I just switched over to Odell.
Oh, yep. Mm-hmm.
I saw their packaging the other day and I'm like, I don't care that this is a Clarity shampoo and I can only use it once a week. I think it's pretty and it smells nice.
Yeah.
You know? Yep. But the other thing is Diva Cup versus Salt. So I went to get a Diva Cup at the store and I walked out with a Salt because the branding is
It was just so good. You're like, oh, this packaging is cute. Oh, I bet you the little cloth bag that it comes in is going to be a lot cuter than whatever this Diva Cup comes in. I mean, Diva Cup is giving like, you know, your 60-year-old like yoga mom, and that's okay, like that's fine, but it's not feeling fresh. And so that's where it's like, it's not to say though that there isn't someone who wants Diva Cup, because there's still a consumer who's going to want that, but yeah, there's also someone who's like, can I get something a little bit cuter, thank you.
Yeah, no, I'm totally that person, especially in like the beauty section. I'm so drawn to like the pretty, and yeah. And then eventually I look deeper. Like, I'm not going to sit there and like Google a product and be like, is this sustainable? Is this ethical? I will say I do prioritize products that aren't made in China.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. For like a lot of things, like especially kids' toys, you just never know. But like for the most part, I'm like, you know what? I'd rather spend a little bit more and support, you know, a business that product is made in the USA. I think that's so cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's just kind of the weird shopper I am, but no, this is not about me. So.
But the thing is, it's important to think about that, because while you are not always the only person who shops, there are folks like you, right? Where it's like price is sensitive. Maybe your brand is like one where it's like, we're not targeting the price sensitive shopper or that price sensitive consumer. So then there are less things to consider. But if you are someone where that is a consideration for that consumer, or rather, if you have a brand where price is a consideration for the consumer, it's important for you to think about how that's showing up. If you're issuing a price increase, if you're bringing in new products and new innovation, how are you making sure that you're still staying true to your brand's core values so that that consumer is still feeling like they're being seen and they're being heard?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's funny too, like on that topic, I switch back and forth. Am I a budget shopper? Am I like, what do I really care about? And actually recently I ended up purchasing from Brooklinen over Boll & Branch for like a duvet cover, mm-hmm, because Brooklinen had a payment plan option. And I was like, this is a huge investment for sheets and a duvet cover. This is insane. Versus Boll & Branch that like maybe might have a 20% off sale coming soon, but like I really want these sheets now. And the difference is like Boll & Branch is ethically sourced, like organic cotton, like that type of thing. And Brooklinen isn't. I think the only thing is like they do prioritize sustainability, but it's like not organic cotton.
Yeah.
So it was just interesting to me. But I'm like, in the future, I'd probably go back to Boll & Branch. I'm that Black Friday spreadsheet person where I've got a whole spreadsheet going and I'm going to click on all the links of things I want on Black Friday and see what the deal is,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, I'm definitely, I mean, as a consumer, I'm less price sensitive if I love it. But I mean, I'm always shopping, not necessarily always buying, but I'm always shopping.
Yeah.
And so I just have my running list of things that I want. And sometimes they go on sale, but I always say, I want to like it enough where I will buy it regardless if it's on sale or not. So
true.
It's definitely like, I love it. And I have a variety of things. I mean, I'm definitely, like I said, fashion and beauty enthusiast. I enjoy shopping.
Yeah, and you can appreciate great products, like, yes, probably more than most consumers.
I really can.
Cool. Okay, well, I kind of want to wrap this by asking, what trends or shifts have you noticed in the beauty industry specifically, because that's your background, and how does that impact the strategies that brands should employ when they're trying to sell to retail?
Yeah, so I think like more and more trends that I'm seeing is just that the DTC model is not profitable. Brands are closing down, are shutting down, and are saying, hey, we're not doing this anymore. I know Unilever just sold off some area of their brand, of brands that they had, smaller brands that they had purchased. And so there is a shift happening in beauty where I think investors are saying, we're not getting the return that we expect to get from beauty. And brands are saying it costs a lot more to acquire new customers where these things aren't affordable. So what I really think that means is the brands that are truly meant to be here, I think that they're going to last. But I think that the brands that are doing almost like a Me Too, like, oh, we were bored during COVID and thought that we would create a beauty brand around sustainability. Like I just wrote a LinkedIn post and said, you know, I hear so many stories about brands and people think that they're unique, but you should really check yourself and ask, is this unique? No longer, if I hear another brand tell me that they're natural, the products are natural, and that that's one of the differentiators, I think I might like pull my hair out. Not really. But it's just one of those things where it's like, have you been sitting under a rock? Having natural ingredients is not new. This is table stakes. This is no longer something that differentiates you from everyone else. This is the cost of admission. And so I think it's really important for brands to stay attuned to what is happening in the market, to understand, are you still trending? Are you still actually doing things that are important? Or has that wave kind of passed? You know, is that now just like part of what you need to do to come to the table? Oh, we're also sustainable, also kind of table stakes. Like everyone has an ESG index these days and is trying to work to be more sustainable. Like, yawn. I'm not, and it's not to say that what you're doing isn't important or that it wasn't difficult. It's more so saying you are no longer differentiated by that being a variable that makes you different from someone else, because everyone now has that. So yeah. Now the differentiation is more so coming in like niches. And I think the interesting thing that I'll be waiting to see with the niches is how scalable those niche brands are, because they're obviously going after a smaller market. And so in going after a smaller market, are they still going to have the same appeal to investors and the same scalability? If we're talking about, like, I think hyperpigmentation for people with melanated skin, okay, that's going to impact a certain aspect of the society, but not folks who maybe are lacking melanin. So it's just different in terms of, yes, there still is a target market there. Like, hey, that product definitely would work for me, right? And my daughters or my family members. But there's also people who wouldn't be able to buy it. Whereas if you were just selling a facial cleanser or something for acne, that is something that is less specific maybe to whether you are someone with melanated skin or not. So then you have a bigger market audience. And so that can appeal to more people. So I think those are, like, in terms of beauty, the bigger things that I'm seeing is that there's just a lot more things that are crowded. The market itself is shifting, but I think it's really pushing brands to ensure that they have a reason for being here. Don't just do this because you felt like there was white space. So many people say that, and it's like, no, the product actually already existed. You didn't do anything different. And I mean, that can be hard to hear because, you know, people look at their businesses like their baby. But it's important to really check and, like, do your due diligence, shop around and really ask yourself, is this truly differentiated? Or did I maybe just search one place and I'm thinking this is different because it's Black owned? Okay. Well, even if it is Black owned, what's the reason why this product is being purchased? If it's based off of cost, you being Black owned might not be the most sustainable thing for you to get into because it's going to be a price to the bottom. And then it's like economies of scale. So.
Oh my gosh. In general, in society, it blows me away. Like this like inventor economy, if you will, and how we're constantly able to rise above and create new things. I used to think a lot as a kid, like, I just had this thought. And I wonder if, like, anyone else in this world have this thought, you know? And then it's, like, a matter of bringing that thought to existence and what capabilities you have. But then at the same time, I'm like, technology. Like, technology's in a cool place right now. I can't imagine what 10 years from now would look like.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it's the same in, you know, in the beauty industry and in CPG industry in general. Like, there's just things we don't know about yet and things that haven't come to light yet. So it's not that it's impossible to get yourself out there, but it's all about the differentiator.
Yeah. It's like, shop around. There's definitely something that has yet to be created or has yet to be positioned in a way where it truly does feel differentiated. But it definitely takes a little bit of work and double clicking to talk about it and make sure you are filling that gap and that need.
100%. 100%. Well, thank you. This has been such an awesome conversation. We haven't really ever brought, I think I told you this, anyone onto the podcast to talk about this, like, the e-com, the D2C, like, the retailer, kind of this, like, product-based side of things. So this was super, super insightful. And again, I thank you for your time today.
No problem. Thank you for having me, Lauren.
All right. Before we fully wrap up, how can people find you online? Of course, we'll include everything in the show notes, but I just wanted to give you that opportunity.
Yes. So I am most active these days on LinkedIn. So you can find me at Monique H. Benoit, M-O-N-I-Q-U-E, Monique like unique, and H as in Harry, and then B-E-N-O-I-T. I'm also on Instagram and TikTok at Monique H. Benoit, but I'm pretty quiet over there these days until I get my, you know, content platform ready to stream and post on all the sites.
Awesome. Sounds good. We'll make sure we include that in the show notes. And thank you again for being on the podcast today.
Thank you. Thank you.